My goal is to just speak briefly about why the hierarchy of the Catholic Church is today favorable towards globalism and hostile to populism, and why I think that the tide is turning and that the Catholic Church is likely to be more, look more favorably on the kinds of commitments expressed at this conference. So why the tilt towards globalism? The Catholic Church enjoyed a great moral prestige after the end of World War II. In the late 1940s and 1950s, prominent Catholic figures played crucial roles in rebuilding the moral and political cultures of Germany and Italy. Now, during the same time, in these decades, in the 40s and 50s, the United Nations had not yet shown itself to be the useless charade that it in fact is. And many in the West invested great hopes in that international body. Thus, mid-century Catholicism tended strongly toward internationalism, as it was then called. By the time of Vatican II, in the early 1960s, church leaders were keen to buttress the authority of the United Nations and other international agencies. And Gaudium et Spes, the document from that council most pointing direct to these kinds of issues, champions the causes of internationalism. And the document goes so far as to call for, I think the term in the document is universal public authority that has the power, as the document says, to ban war. And John Paul II and Benedict XVI in their pontificates both reiterated versions of this call for a universal governing authority, a universal public authority. Now, it's important to see that Gaudium et Spes in the mid-1960s church was not without counter-emphases. The text consistently speaks of the community of nations and doesn't seem to suggest a post-national future. And the council was held at a time of rapid decolonization. And Gaudium et Spes and the church at large supported this process, which is effectively third world nationalism. And Gaudium et Spes defines a right, it speaks of a right to one's own culture. Yet the same document also notes and champions the development of, quote, a more universal form of human culture. So there's obviously tensions in the documents. And it envisions a globalized economic development with experts running things in accord with supposedly objective and scientific principles. So there's obviously tensions within the document. And those tensions are manifest because in the church's judgments about political matters in second half of the 20th century, which have not turned out to be very astute. During the 1960s, the Catholic hierarchy, like so many others, was deeply concerned about the arms race and the threats of a catastrophic nuclear war. And this was the major, really the overriding reason for emphasizing this notion of a universal public authority. Yet, as the decades played out, it was nation states that prevented war with a strategy of deterrence, not the United Nations. And the same nations negotiated arms reductions and other measures to de-escalate potential conflicts. Thus, looking back, we can see that strong nations and not international bodies successfully managed the threats of nuclear war. Another misjudgment, mid-century Catholic leaders vested a great deal of confidence in international agencies to press forward economic development in the impoverished regions of the world. And again, that confidence was misplaced. In the event, the countries in which international agencies have penetrated most deeply have languished, while China, which kept the international community very much at arm's length, has seen remarkable growth. Now, before his election to the papacy, John Paul II was frustrated by the Vatican's diplomacy towards the Eastern Bloc. And I think this little episode tells us something about the church's sensibilities in the second half of the 20th century. Because Vatican officials thought that prudence required finding a modus vivendi that downplays troublesome issues. And the Polish cardinal knew otherwise. But even as the head of the church, he had difficulty bringing his own diplomats in line with a more confrontational approach. And so, whether it's Ostpolitik or international development or preventing nuclear war, what explains these missteps? I think I see here an age-old truth, and that is like seeks like. Gigantic global corporations like Google want to relate to global public authorities. It is more efficient than dealing with the many different countries. And the same holds for the Vatican. The Catholic Church is the oldest bureaucracy in the West, and it's international in scope. It's natural that Roman officials would wish to meet with their equivalents, which is one reason why a previous generation of Vatican officials was comfortable with representatives from the Soviet Empire, while today's Vatican is comfortable with Davos executives, EU bureaucrats, and NGO heads rather than populist politicians. I do think it's a big function of this is like seeks like. And another reason is because in the second half of the 20th century, there were obvious reasons to take a dim view of European nationalism. There were obvious It had played a leading role in two devastating wars. For this reason, the church became a staunch ally of the internationalist faction in the West after 1945. And the same social situation, I would argue, allied the church with what I would think of as a moderate liberalism, which went under the name of Christian democracy. And I think it's the same Eurocentric view, in other words, the devastation of the war and so forth, the same Eurocentric view that allowed Roman officials to paradoxically champion struggles of decolonization, which featured very strong nationalist rhetoric in the former colonies, as well as kind of third world Marxism rather than a moderate liberalism as they championed in Europe. But we don't live in 1945, or for that matter, in 1965, when Vatican II ended and Gaudium et Spes was promulgated. As a consequence, I believe that we will see changes in the kinds of political judgments that guide official Catholic policy with respect to political developments in the West and the world more broadly. Why is this the case? It's the case because the problems of the West today flow from the weakening of the institutions that command loyalty and demand sacrifice. And Bob Royal spoke about those institutions, and the most important ones are the church, the family, and civic life, or polity, or the nation. We are living in a time of unprecedented infertility in the rich world. And it's also a time of unprecedented indifference toward transcendence. And it's an era of both waning patriotism and multicultural fragmentation of national identities. These are the sources of almost all of our problems in the West. And these declines have significant moral and spiritual consequences. As the demands for loyalty and sacrifice decline, a kind of pallid individualism emerges that is concerned only with maximizing utility. The heroic humanism, the Promethean humanism of Immanuel Kant or even Friedrich Nietzsche is very much a thing of the past. The West today is demoralized, docile, and placid. We are largely satisfied now with legalized pot and cheap holidays. Now, I wrote a book, Return of the Strong Gods, about our descent into Achadia, the sense of despairing lack of concern about ultimate things, the condition of not believing that there is anything of metaphysical importance to rouse our soul. So I'm not going to bore you by recounting my argument, but I think it's sufficient here simply to restate the main thesis. And it's this. The American-led reconstruction of the West after World War II emphasized what I call open society motifs that sought to weaken the institutions that command loyalty and demand sacrifice. Frankfurt School features figures such as Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno deemed these loyalty-commanding, sacrifice-demanding institutions as crypto-fascist. And the main ambition of this reconstruction of the West was simple. To put it bluntly, if we can convince people that there's nothing worth fighting for, then nobody will fight. Now, when he coined the term dictatorship of relativism, Pope Benedict pointed out the spiritual dead end to which the West has come as a result of this strategy. But the Catholic Church is a gigantic battleship. It turns slowly in the water, often very slowly. For example, to this day, the Church treats the documents of the Second Vatican Council, which are now 60 years old, as if they were written yesterday. And the current pontificate is, moreover, hopelessly nostalgic. Pope Francis surrounds himself by people who act as though it's always 1965. Nevertheless, I would submit there are signs of change. I mentioned Pope Benedict and his warnings against the dictatorship of relativism, and I would also point to John Paul II's encyclical Veritatis Splendor. That document strongly affirms the authority of moral truth. And under Ratzinger's leadership, the Vatican reasserted the universal lordship of Christ. And while he was, when he was Pope, Benedict called for a more dignified and transcendent style of worship. All of these are theological affirmations that seek to buttress the capacity of the Church to command loyalty and to evoke sacrifice. I mean, that's all of those measures to buttress the capacity of the Church to command loyalty and to evoke sacrifice. So when it comes to the spiritual life, we can therefore see a kind of strengthening trend, I would call it, in the Catholic Church. It's by no means uniform. The German Church seems to be committed to ever greater weakening, and Pope Francis often emphasizes permission rather than prohibition. But in my travels, I can report a growing consensus. As a priest friend put it, we live in a season in which we need to rebuild the walls of the church. Now, any talk of walls sounds positively populist. But let me set that aside for a moment and point out that the church has become more outspoken in defense of marriage, in defense of family, and more recently, in defense of the fundamental difference between men and women. Pope Francis himself has described transgender ideology as demonic. Thus, I think we're seeing a change in Catholicism. In the years immediately after the Second Vatican Council, theologians and clergy treated the old piety of before the council in the same way that secular leaders treated the old patriotism. They thought it was overdone and it could serve as an impediment to a fuller and more open way of living. As a consequence, they problematized church authority, these theologians and clergy after the council, and emphasized what I would call an open faith, analogous to the open society themes of the post-war secular elites. But again, my travels, I can see that this approach is falling by the wayside. Today, we're entering a period of theological and moral reconsolidation in the church, wall building, as it were. As these winds of change blow, I predict a growing skepticism about globalism within the church. After all, globalism is a dissolving project that aims to weaken national loyalties and create a new man, the proverbial global citizen. But the so-called global community is an abstraction that demands no concrete loyalty. The church transcends nations, to be sure, but church leaders, I think today, increasingly intuitively recognize that faith flourishes in a culture of love and loyalty, not in a utilitarian paradise ruled by public health officials and central bankers. The West needs a politics of love. It needs that politics of love in order to cure its spiritual torpor. Populism and other movements champion the nation as worthy of our loyalty. These political uprisings against globalism are invitations to love again, to love who we are and who we might become as a people. These populist trends frighten those weaned on open society motifs that see fascism in anything ardent and in anything affirming. But we're living, folks, in 2021, not in 1939. In an era where Greta Thunberg is our prophet, our problems arise from a weary despair. Sustainability is a goal of desperation, that the best thing we can achieve is just to keep what we have. There's no ambition in that, no spiritual ambition in that whatsoever. Now, renewing faith and buttressing the family are obviously the royal roads to any lasting remedy to this weary despair. But also, restoring metaphysical dignity to political life is important as well. In view of our history, nationalism is the most likely way to recover the sacred character of our civic covenants. So in conclusion, I would say the Catholic faithful are not stupid. They sense that, if I may borrow the phrase, there is a seamless garment of love and loyalty. Renewing a nation's claim on our hearts must be a preparatory element of the main task facing the church, which is to renew the authority of moral law and deepen our sense of duty toward God. Mario Salvini may have been cynically calculating when he waved his rosary beads at a political rally, and politicians often are cynically calculating. But the symbolism is not false. Faith, family, and nation are different, and they must be kept distinct. But they are linked by a shared pattern of loyalty and sacrifice. And it's that pattern that we need to recover. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I think we've had three phenomenal presentations in this.